Hey guys, good morning.
Good morning.
That's encouraging. So I was looking at all the verses that contain the word parakleo for the past month or so. And of all the verses, I found the most important. By the way, the word parakleo can be translated as begged. This verse isn't on your sheet, though. This is so it's at Acts 13:42. So when the Jews went out of the synagogue, the Gentiles begged that these words might be preached to them the next Sabbath. That was a joke, because I wanted you guys to beg me to do this again next Sunday. But anyways, there's take a look at that first verse below the title, 1 Samuel 36. And David was greatly distressed. The people spake of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and for his daughters. But David encouraged himself in the Lord. The context of this is David and company come back to their homeland or to some land, and all their people are gone. They've been captured. So that would be pretty devastating. But David is the one who encourages himself in the Lord, and he prays to God after this verse, and God says, "You're going to go get everyone back." And he does that, which is pretty cool. Before we get started, take a look at question 6 at the bottom. What is the basis of being encouraged, of being strong-hearted and steadfast? Just keep that in mind as we go through. So I'm going to start out with looking at the word parakleo. There are several different translations of the word: beseech, encourage, exhort, entreat, plead, pray, comfort, and so forth. The word is composed of the prefix para, near, and kaleo, to call. First, I want to go over the word kaleo. It's just the word to call, like I said. It's used by Jesus when he calls people to repentance. He says, "For I am not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance." It's also used to invite people to a certain banquet in Luke. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind. It's also used as in naming things. So like, this is called a room, it's called a window. That called word, kaleo. For para, it means from, of, at, by, besides, or near. Parakaleo means to call alongside, or to call near. Like when you tell your dog to heel. You mean, come walk at my heel alongside me and don't run out into the traffic. It differs from regular old kaleo in that the calling is in reference to something else. It's usually a kind of behavior or desire of the caller. It's usually used with more expression and drama than kaleo. Here are some uses of the word in the New Testament that you might not be aware of. Jesus can parakaleo God. Matthew 26:53 says, "Or do you think that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he will provide me with more than 12 legions of angels?" That pray word, that's parakaleo. Demons parakaleo Jesus, and he grants their desire. And Mark 5:12-13. So all the demons begged him, saying, "Send us to the swine that we may enter them." And at once, Jesus gave them permission. Townspeople parakaleo Jesus to depart, which is interesting because they don't want them to come near him, but they want him to go away. And behold, the whole city came out to meet Jesus. And when they saw him, they begged him to depart from their region. Consider the word paranormal. Paranormal occurrences are those that are beyond or above normal occurrences. Paracalling, so to speak, is often calling that is more than regular calling, more emphatic, more expressive, and therefore is translated as implore, entreat, beg, etc. Aside from these extra mannerisms associated with the act of paracleoing, its basic meaning is to call alongside. In Acts, when the traveling eunuch wants Philip to help him understand Isaiah, so the eunuch is in a chariot, Acts says, he asked Philip to come up and sit with him. The asked word, that's parakaleo. It's also translated as desired in I think the King James. The eunuch is simply asking Philip to come to him. It is also used when you want someone to come to you conceptually, not just to call someone physically near you, but to come near you in thinking and attitude. Paul says, as an example, Paul says to the church at Corinth, "Therefore I urge you, imitate me." The urge is parakleia. Now this is not just physically, like Simon says, the imitation, but spiritually. He doesn't want them to imitate his movements, but his walking with God. Many uses of parakleio are about living rightly with God. For example, he encouraged them all that with purpose of heart they should continue with the Lord. But first, let's delve a little deeper into some non-biblical uses of parakleio and the words that it has been translated into. Oh, I love this part. Okay, so, and Thucydides in the Peloponnesian War. The context is that Corinth and Athens are not getting along, and at the crux of the dispute is a Corinthian colony, Potidaea. Thucydides writes, "But the siege of Potidaea put an end to her inaction. Immediately summoning the allies to Sparta, she came and loudly accused Athens of breach of the treaty." So, and what happens there at the treaty is Corinth will try to convince all her allies to declare war on Athens. So you can see that the parakleion is, Corinth is parakleioing her allies to come in line with Corinth's agenda. And another use of it in Anabasis by Xenophon, "Let us not wait for others to come to us and summon us to the noblest deeds." This was a great use of the word parakleio because it really shows that you can be called to a certain kind of action. And in this case, noble deeds, which I think is a common use of the New Testament writers. And so I'm just going to poke around here at the different words that it was translated into. This is not by any means exhaustive, but it gives you an example of what kind of research goes into trying to figure out what a word means. So looked up exhort in English sources. It's used in Foreign Affairs as the recurring educational campaigns exhort party members to live plainly, struggle hard, and warn them not to wallow in luxuries and pleasures. Again, you can see that there's a certain kind of behavior that's being exhorted. In the New York Times, a brigade of students on campus, known as eco-reps, who cajole and exhort their peers to reduce their carbon footprints. Notice that parakleioing may not always be accompanied by niceness, but it's, again, the emphasis is to call people alongside a certain kind of action or thinking. Looked up courage and encouraging comfort. One of the basic things I found out about courage is it really has to do with the heart. And that was very insightful, so keep that in mind as I go over these. So the etymology of courage is a Romanic word, and it comes from the word coraticum, cor meaning heart, and edge is a suffix for abstract nouns. So then courage is the heart as the seat of feeling, thought, etc., spirit, mind, disposition, nature. This is an obsolete definition, but I think it was illuminating because it showed that like courage isn't just bravery, but it's really the core of a person's essence and what kind of motivates their decisions to either be brave or to not be brave. And then encourage then would be to inspire with courage, to animate your spirit. Again, not just puffing people up, but really trying to get their engine, their essence, onto the right tracks. Then comfort was also a word that I really wanted to know about because it's often translated into, parakleio is often translated into the word comfort. And again, another obsolete definition, but nonetheless insightful. To strengthen morally or spiritually, to encourage, harden in spirit and sight. So, to comfort then isn't just, again, to kind of puff up with empty words, but it's to fortify or to really strengthen a person when they're under attack. But you want to be careful not to build a fortress around someone if they're behaving poorly, because that's protecting poor behavior, and it makes it more difficult for them to get back onto the right tracks if they're encumbered down by all these stones. So that was that could really help me to understand more about the difference between the English and the Greek. As you read the text, you'll see Like this is a word that's used over 100 times in the New Testament and translated in over like a dozen different English words, so it can get kind of confusing. So I wanted to really kind of hone in on some of the words behind all this language stuff. So I'm going to exposit my New Testament study now. In the Gospel and the Acts, it's mainly used of others when they parakleo Jesus. You can go over these verses here. They begged him they might only touch the hem of his garment, and then he does heal them, or they are healed. Then they brought to him one who was deaf and had an impediment in his speech, and they begged him to put his hand on him. And he fell down at Jesus' feet and begged him to come to his house. The disciples had heard that Peter was there. They sent two men to him, imploring him not to delay in coming to them. Then in Acts, we begin to see more uses in which the benefit is for those being parakleo. For example, strengthening the souls of the disciples, exhorting them to continue in the faith, and saying, "We must, through many tribulations, enter the kingdom of God." Encouragement often opposes those things that are discouraging. So look at that. That's a really great exhortation. The author is aware that these people are going through tribulations. And so he reminds them that they're not in vain. That could be discouraging if you're going through tribulations. So exhortation often works as a counterforce to those things that are discouraging. In the epistles, this was really great to see these master parakleos at their art, at the height of their art. First, they really understand the kind of behavior that pleases God and that is good for people to follow. And they also really know how to communicate this truth in such a way that is sincere and uplifting. So the kind of behavior that is called for, that is exhorted, is holy living. Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. Finally then, brethren, we urge and exhort in the Lord Jesus, that you should abound more and more, just as you receive from us how you ought to walk and to please God. Therefore, I exhort, first of all, that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men. But rather do them service, because they are faithful and beloved, partakers of the benefit. These things teach and exhort. I, therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling with which you are called. The kind of behavior that is exhorted is for us to follow. For us to follow is to abstain from fleshly lusts, to abound, to walk worthily, to please God, to pray, to serve. These are the things that Jesus did and Paul did, Paul and others did before us, so we should come alongside them and continue in the faith. Note that the kind of behavior they're parakleoing is contrary to the behavior that we see every day, that we go to work with every day, that we're inundated with every day. Why do you think good behavior needs to be encouraged? Do you think bad behavior needs to be encouraged? So, to go over the next thing is the context of its use. This was, again, very edifying, because at first I had just kind of isolated, you know, you run a search and you see all these really isolated uses of the word parakleo. So I really zoomed in, especially to this letter to the Thessalonians, and got a sense for the big picture. And what's going on here is basically Paul and company came to the Thessalonians, they brought the gospel to them, they poured out their hearts and their souls into these people. And this was right after Paul and company had suffered affliction when they were at Philippi. And not only that, but the Thessalonians are now suffering persecution from their own countrymen. So everyone's under affliction, and Paul has to go after he has taught them the gospel. And so Paul's writing to them, and he's saying, I'm encouraging you, because I know that you're under affliction, and I really want to see you to know how your faith is doing. So when he encourages them here, he sent Timothy, our brother and minister of God, and our fellow laborer in the gospel of Christ, to establish you and encourage you concerning your faith. He's doing that in the context of all this affliction that's going on for everyone. And he says, "For in fact we told you before, when we were with you, that we would suffer tribulation, just as it happened, and you know. For this reason, when I could no longer endure it, I sent to know your faith, lest by some means the tempter had tempted you, and our labor might be in vain." The Thessalonians were afflicted. They had suffered persecution from their own countrymen. Paul was taken away from these people he dearly cared for while they were suffering. He wanted to see them and to know their faith, how they were handling this pressure, this affliction. For if they had in some way failed, Paul's labor would be in vain. In order to help them remain faithful, he sent Timothy to establish and encourage them. And then I would also compare establish to the word fortify. A lot of encouragement has to do with this idea of strength or having defenses against all that other stuff that we're being afflicted with. And then he also, as a part of this exhortation, he gives reason why they shouldn't be shaken. Again, like if you're strong, if you're founded, if you have deep roots, you won't be shaken. And the reason that they shouldn't be shaken by these affliction is because it's all part of the plan. It's basically what Paul's saying. He's like, we told you about this. You knew it was coming. Why are you surprised? But he doesn't say it quite like that. And then in Jude, so we're still in context, 2BII. "Beloved, while I was very diligent to write to you concerning our common salvation, I found it necessary to write to you, exhorting you contend earnestly for the faith, which is once for all delivered to the saints." So basically, there are these deceivers in the church that Jude is writing to, and they've come in and they're deceiving and they're up to their old tricks, and that's not acceptable. So Paul is writing to them to contend for their faith and to not fall to this temptation, to these temptations that these deceivers are giving. I would really encourage you guys, sorry, that was totally off the cuff, to go through these letters. They're really short, but it really give you a good sense of what's going on with this encouragement and of how to do it. And again, just study how Paul uses it and how Jude uses it. So 2BIII is the function compared to the behavior of the context. So those who swim upstream need to band together. Mutual encouragement is an effective force against this world's current. So this is really cool. I wrote some good stuff for this. Exhortation and encouragement are vital functions of the body. Imagine you're alone and that you're a fish. Specifically, a salmon making the upstream swim for the survival of your species. For the average upstreamer, the journey home, because they're going back to where they were born, the journey home is 150 miles. But for some salmon, it's 200 or more miles long and 200 or more feet high. You are committed for the long haul, and you've been going strong for 500 miles. But all of a sudden, you feel a little winded. So you look to your left and to your right, without even turning your neck, and you see a few other fish along for the ride. They call out to you, "Hey, Moby, you're doing great. Be strong. Stroke like this. Where we're going, it's worth it." And you reply, "Thanks, Dan." Gotcha. So Philippians 4:2. I implore Euodia, and I implore Syntyche, to be of the same mind in the Lord. When you're in the same mind, it's kind of like the music. Like there's the sheet, there's the words, the things that's supposed to be going on, and the beat, and everybody is on the same page. Literally, it's much easier to do what's right, to obey, and to go against the flow. Colossians 2:2, that their hearts might may be encouraged, being knit together in love, and attaining to all riches of the full assurance of understanding to the knowledge of the mystery of God, both of the Father and of Christ. Being knit together in love, that's really cool imagery. You know how bulletproof vests work? They're just really dense fibers, and they're really tightly knit. It's not like steel, where it's just, you know, one material, but it's a bunch of small fibers, and that's how it can protect you from bullets and stuff, because the bullet hits it, and then it's all the forces that fuse throughout the cool bulletproof vest. The other thing I thought of too, of this idea of being knit together, and when you get a lot of people going in the same direction, that creates its own force. So imagine if you had millions of fish going upstream. Then maybe it's more like the water is going upstream, right? Compared to the flow of the fish. So it's good to stick together and to encourage one another according to the truth. Your hearts, right. So your heart needs to be in the right place, tying up with others who have your best interests at heart, who will encourage you by reminding you of the rewards of our faithfulness as a proven way to live a blessable life. Notice that in that Colossians 2:2 verse, he reminds them about the riches of the full assurance of understanding. Hebrews 3:13, but exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. We live in the world every day. Every day we face its challenges and barrage of temptations, diversions, and lies. It can be discouraging, but daily encouragement to continue resisting, to keep on fighting the good fight, can diminish their influence and convince us to be constantly vigilant. We're in this together, so encourage others and be encouraged by them. Also, by those who've gone before us, especially the author and the finisher of our faith, who has been tempted in every way we are. It's not just a long trip, but one marked by suffering and obstacles, but obstacles to be overcome. For the fish on the way upstream, I did some more research, the salmon face fishermen, fish ladders, waterfalls, more predators, and pollution. It's already an upstream battle, but wait, there's more. The deceiver and his minions are doing everything in their power to get us to go down the drain. Therefore, exhorting the truth is important for strengthening the heart against deceitful pleasures and the ease of going with the flow. If all that stuff is working against you, you want all the support you can get. And the great thing is that God designed this body for the purpose to be knit together in love and to encourage and fortify one another where encouragement is needed. Just as function, rebuke has a different function than encouragement. So let's go over these verses. Timothy 5:1. Do not rebuke an old man, but exhort him as a father, younger men as brothers. Preach the word, be ready in season and out of season. Convince, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and teaching. Speak these things, exhort and rebuke with all authority. Let no one despise you. Rebuke is to bring to light where someone or something misses the mark. It's really to point out where someone is failing to live biblically. Paracleting, on the other hand, is usually to try to persuade others to live biblically. This can be for people who are already living biblically, or those who are slacking a bit. Paracloying might be accompanied with rebuke or admonishment, but it's not the same thing. And then various nuances which are important to keep in mind, and particularly, you know, this idea from sound doctrine, you know, you can be paracloed to do bad behavior. It is possible, so be on your guard for that. But exhort what is true from sound doctrine by the mercies of God through the Lord and the love of the Spirit. I want to go through this conclusion where God, certainly an awesome paraclerer, really encourages Joshua. Really cool stuff here. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given you, as I said to Moses. Note, God gives us the place where we walk. And that's an encouraging thought. The course we're on is hard, but it was not made with the intention of our failure. God knows what he's doing. He knows the path that will get us to the best place out of this world. From the wilderness, look at all the stuff he gives them, too. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, as far as the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and to the great sea, toward the going down of the sun, shall be your territory. Wow. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you, nor forsake you. God encourages Joshua by reminding him that man has no power over him, and that God has a good track record. God is faithful. If God said it, it's going to happen. And he said this stuff so Joshua does not need to be afraid or be discouraged. Be strong and of good courage, for to this people you shall divide as an inheritance the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. God made us a part of his plan, so we can be strong and have good courage, so like good soldiers are with a general who has a good plan. If you trust your leader, then that really helps in believing that what you're doing is worth it, and that you're hunkered down and you're standing firm and you're not going to give up because you know that your general needs you there, and that the victory will come if you do what your general needs you to do. Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. Those Hebrew words, I love words. The strong word, chazak, is the strength that it means to fasten upon. Again, you can kind of think of it as like the power to like grip something, to fasten. And then emat is very courageous. It's to be alert, physically or mentally. In the physical sense, it's to be like alert with your feet. Like I don't know if I guess some of you do taekwondo, but you're on the balls of your feet, like you're ready to fight or to bounce or to spin or kick. And but to be alert mentally, what does that mean? And that's the courage part. That's the being alert mentally, so that you won't be diverted by afflictions. So that you will be of good courage and that you'll be strong-minded. Doing God's will is hard. You need power and vigilance. That's kind of how I translated it, as this mental alertness, vigilance. So you need power and vigilance to do it. God exhorts Joshua to be such, to be strong, and to be very courageous. And he also reminds Joshua the result of staying on the course, of tracking alongside God's commands, is that you'll prosper wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate in it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. In addition to strength and courage, you need the word. How do you use the word? God says, meditate on it and then do it. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Be strong and be of good courage. I'm getting a message here. And do not be afraid, nor be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. God reminds Joshua that God is with him. And will not every outcome be decided by whether or not God is with you? As we were praising this morning and going through the songs and praising God, the thought occurred to me, I was like, if you knew who our God is, how could you be discouraged? And that kind of brings us back to that question down at the bottom, it's number 6. And what David does in the verse 1 Samuel 3:30-6, he encourages himself in the Lord. And it's really cool. Xenophon, I didn't plan this, but Xenophon, when he says in Anabasis, "Let us not wait for others to come to us and summon us to the noble steeds," I thought it was interesting. So, do you guys have any questions? Yes, Dan.
Do you think, can parakaleo be in passive form? Do you think that we can call people and encourage people and not actually have like a conversation with them just by, what we were seeing, like what Michelle was saying, basically people being a witness? Do you think that's parakaleo maybe in a passive form? By living your life, and so maybe swimming upstream, people take note of that, and then you're saying, come with me.
I understand what you're saying. I don't think it would technically be parakaleo, okay. But it might have the same effect as exhortation. Okay. But all the uses that I saw of it, it's definitely kind of a voiced, sort of specific definition of this or that, what to do. But I think that when you set the example, you see Paul in the, when his letters to Thessalonians, he's like, you see how he conducted yourself. Paul says the letter that to the Thessalonians, he said, you see how we conducted ourselves while we were with you. We labored so that we weren't a burden to you. So if you're trying to exhort someone, but you don't have that passive form as you're talking about, the lead by example form, it's not as effective, not nearly as effective.
I was thinking, just to reiterate your first response, if you're committed to do something, you need some sort of indication that it's happening or not, that it's done or not. So you're calling someone alongside, you basically say, yeah, that's happening. Whether or not people are kind of catching the very dust fallout, or that, you know, really, that's kind of nebulous. Although I totally agree it does happen.
Yes, Yuen?
So your very first verse says David encouraged himself in the Lord. So in this situation, I guess, like, everyone is distressed, and when no one around you could parakaleo you, you have to encourage yourself in the Lord. How do you do that?
You go to God and you look at what He said, and then you look at what the world is saying to you. And you look at what how you feel, and then you see if that is in line with what God said. And then you realize, wow, look at all this other stuff. You know, God is all powerful. God is with me. God answers prayer. And I think that's how you can encourage yourself in the Lord. Again, if you know who our God is, it would be very difficult to kind of rationally be discouraged. Because He's with us, and if the omnipotent, omniscient force of everything is with you, I'm good to go. Yeah, right? Is that's? Did I answer your question?
So I guess you open the Bible and try to study His character and try to know Him, and remind myself who He is.
Yes.
I think this other piece of David, frequently he's very conscious of the fact that he's where he is and doing what he's doing because of what God has done in his life. And he's actually in this bad situation when people want to stone him because he was doing what God wanted him to do. So it's like, the only reason I'm in this is because God put me in this, so it's really not my fault. So, you know, it's their problem if they want to stone me. Of course, it's going to be my problem if they actually hit me.
Or, yeah, think of, make sure I get the name right here. Joseph, when he's sold by his brothers to Pharaoh, and he's in that pot, I think he's in an urn or something. Or maybe a well. But I always think of that as a very dark place, and yet, that's where God allowed him to be. And so, take heart, be of good courage.
Did you see any example in the Bible where people were paracleting others to even pass them in the journey? Say, suppose if we use the analogy that the Christian life is like climbing a mountain, and you call alongside someone to climb the mountain up with you, but your goal and intent is that you would all be climbing at the same pace, but at some point if their capacity exceeds yours, for them to continue on the journey with the principles that you've taught to even surpass, is it possible?
I see what you're saying. The first thing that comes to mind when you mention that is Jesus says that you'll do greater things than I. He also says, I'm pretty sure, that no student surpasses his master instructor, maybe? Yeah. No? Oh. Oh, no, no, please. Okay. Right. Then, yeah, then maybe it's not there.
We have that thing where John says, when he must increase, I must decrease. And so you actually do want to have the guy go beyond.
Okay.
Just like Jesus.
It also says in John, like, a servant should not be greater than his master.
Okay.
Everyone that fully trains will be like their master. Right. But then Jesus did say you go on to do greater things than I did. So it was two different contexts where you can't draw a general principle out of either one
So you're talking about the discipleship context, like you would look to disciple them and have them ask you in your relationship with God. I would think that someone would not. Why would you want to not have the same thing? I mean, is that what you mean though? To have someone else have a better, stronger relationship with God than you?
Just in the sports context, you can definitely teach people to kind of excel more than you've done yourself. I think also if you disciple somebody, they spend at some point more time in the Word and we have a close relationship with God, they can definitely achieve more than you do yourself. And then it's not just the result of the things that you've done, but what God is teaching them themselves.
Yeah, I agree.
I
think you can, but would that be the goal?
Not goal, just can.
Like, would I go out decide this and hoping to have them pass me up? I would be able to care clear all the time because I know.
Isn't the goal of every teacher deep down inside with the hope that they can teach somebody or have a class of maybe $50, there's one bright light and that person will go on and exceed even what the teacher can do? Is that how we teach
the thing is, if you're a teacher in a school, you generally aren't going much further in pursuing your field itself. Whereas I'm imagining that if Corey's going to go paraclete out, she's also going to be searching God in her own time and bettering herself. So, I mean, if you're helping someone and they do pass you, I mean, where were you going there? Are you standing still?
Well, that's what I'm looking at.
Yeah.
What's happening to Elizabeth? My goal is to help other people, mature beyond me. I mean, am I not holding my responsibility? Like, I would think
might be more granular than that. It might be a different capacity or skill set. Some people have become a general skill for people interaction. So they may surpass you in a ministry element. Or someone might be really academically minded and surpass you in Bible study skills. I think, if I'm not mistaken, that might be kind of what you're thinking of. There might be some element, some aspect that someone could surpass you in because of their skill or ability, stronger than yours.
Well, in terms of walking with God, you tell our kids, you should do better than we did because you've had so much more than we have. But you have a better foundation than we did. So theoretically, where you come into the process, they should exceed where the parents are. It's not just the parents, are going to slack off, but we don't.
Have you talked to the TAP students that turn out to be better TAP dancers than you?
I haven't for a year, so I don't know. I absolutely am trying to help them maximize their potential. I guess my concern is the person doing the teaching that you would not seek to still strive to have an imitatable walk with God. That's what I'm talking about. My issue is that you would think that teaching someone else to have a stronger relationship with God is the goal versus trying to strive to be imitatable and be able to pair play.
Being paracleted by somebody else, so it's like a chain. It's not like one-on-one, but you're paracleting this person, I'm just paracleting you, so it's
a good 10 years of that.
There was a book a couple years ago, I think I gave it to Barbara, it's about disciple making. And in there, in the very beginning, the guy was discussing how to pick your disciple leading. And basically, they're not progressing to just be away from and find that one that does progress. But there's like four or five sections or more where it got to the point where you no longer need to have that face-to-face time anymore. They're actually doing and producing more disciples. So you actually took them to a level that's beyond you, in the fact that they're kind of started their own cell. And I don't remember that book there.
I think it's if you take them to a level where they have become equipped to grow in the relationship with God on their own. Mm. So they no longer need the same kind of involvement from you. So it doesn't really touch on this point of surpassing. So I think kids in different areas over the time. And, you know, I remember my old pastor when he was in his 80s, and he felt like he was frustrated that his physical infirmities kept him from being used by God. I mean, if you're faithful and you keep obeying, that's going to continue. I don't know that you don't come back necessarily, but you want to equip people so that they become independent and you can pursue them, can obey God on their own. They don't need you to do that.
The problem.
Shouldn't be the goal.
The problem with most books on discipleship is they're written by people who have a parachurch disciple-making ministry. And the idea is that, you know, they help someone get to the point where they go up with God and then encourage them to go do it with someone else. The biblical model is disciple-making. It's a team sport that happens in a church. So it's the body building up the body. And the product of the body should be greater than, you know, the sum of the individual parts. So, you know, there's many sources that come into a person's life that help them grow when they're part of the body. Just that everybody, in the same way, Ephesians 4 says everybody provides to cause the growth of the body. So there's two different models that are kind of being presented. And of course, you have to come home with the biblical way the body produces the site, people may be people rather than just one individual producing them. So the question is if they're going to surpass an individual, but they're going to part of the body creates more of the body.
Yes?
So you mentioned you're saying talk, saying you can do great looking that media, that's mentioned in the Bible. I'm just curious where that phrase is coming from.
I don't know the verse off the top of my head.
What's the verse?
Jesus says you will do greater things than I. Yeah, I think it's basic idea that about God is that he's just, which means that he punishes those who don't obey him and that he rewards those who do obey him. Is that relevant to your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think her question more like, what are some of the outward rituals that she sees other groups practice, and the other group claim that by following certain rituals that will make you closer to God versus other things are not necessarily
ritual-based, or are truth-digging. Is that right? Yeah. And then by engaging certain rituals versus engaging other activities, you know, how are those rituals or activities going to bring you closer to God?
I have this friend, I'm apologizing, kind of deviating from the world.
You know, he's a Christian, he's a peaceful Christian, but then he tries to direct me to certain churches that were Bible study. So I go to one, and then I go to a different one. like saying, oh, if you don't, like the way you're saying, if you don't believe in God, and then you go to hell, and then you go to, I think that's probably where we prove. That's a very insensitive way to say that, because people have the past, you know, you have your time to follow God. People, I would thought people would create evil, and because then I will sometimes feel discouraged and saying, why you told me to go to hell because I didn't believe that. Then I talked to him, he's saying actually those people should be sensitive. If they don't say that, then you might make the newcomers more feel lovely. Sometimes they feel, I mean, forced, like saying, okay, you're in or out, you're in with us. I think that's very, in my opinion, I think that's very judgmental, because I don't think that's right. And then, I mean, I don't know.
I understand.
Maybe I'm a problem. I'm just either I'm just being or outspoken.
Thank you.
And also, I think just to cover up one about you're saying some of the great teachers, you know, on your pupils. I think that will be the right way to do. Then you hope one of those maybe will surpass you, then the whole society will grow.
And
from the control point of view, of course, if I think I'm the master, of course, I want everybody to obey me. Then yeah, that's no chaos, but I'm not sure. And depending on this superior power, how superior it is, otherwise it is very limited by what he's telling me to do. And I guess I'm still in a pretty beginner level, but I'm just saying this whole ideology thing, I think, you know, just from a very naive point of view, at least we're kind of worshiping God, with a little superior power instead of like one physical person, because everybody has limitations. If you're only ruled by some physical person, then that's doomed to be bad, because then if he has his own limitation, then every single thing, if I don't listen to him, then I'm punished, and then I always have to listen to him. Then how about his judgment is wrong? But I'm just, because I'm from China, so I just feel like
the whole thing. I definitely think, yeah, God's definitely the master above all men. So definitely, he's the standard, regardless of where other men are, whether or not, or women, whether or not they have been teaching you or not. Definitely, you know, if they're not doing something that God wants, then you should surpass them in that area. I agree.
No,
never mind.
How do you know something specific? Like, how would you summarize
hatred and sisterhood, because it doesn't always happen. So when you say it, do you notice anything particular during your studies of the things that will warn against this, and like being in the body and not having that encouragement
is going to make it harder for you to encourage others, for example? Right. I see. Are you asking me if there were themes in the content of the paracling that I saw? Mm-hmm. Or if not, then just general recommendations for things to be aware of that would.
Okay. From paraclaiming. Okay. First of all, I did see a lot of the paraclaiming was, and I wrote this on the sheet, is tailored to the needs of the people that are being paraclaimed. So I realize that that takes a lot of thought, as from the perspective of the person that is doing the encouragement, to really be other-centered and put themselves in the other person's shoes. And I think that might be something that's difficult about it. And then things that would hinder you from paracloying others. I think that if you don't have a good idea of the relationships in the body, then you wouldn't know, you'd just kind of be throwing like arbitrary encouragements out. Randomly, which is you know, that it's, you don't want to carpet bomb the body with encouragements. Just really being other-centered and having an awareness of the needs, I think is an important part, and one that might hinder, I guess, if you didn't have a real intimate kind of, yeah, maybe that's the right word, but at least some awareness of what's going on. I think. Yes, Rainy.
I have another question. Are we good with that one? Okay. Do you see paraclete more as Bible study, accountability, fellowship, or do you see it all, but like one-on-one members, something else all the way?
Oh, so like those are categories, and yeah. Is paracleting in one of those categories? I think it's, you could group it in like the one another passages, if you will. It's like one category is interactions amongst believers. So that could be considered fellowship, body life. I think, yeah, so its function is within kind of the body life. It would be difficult to paracleo if there was no one to paracleo beside yourself. But you can pray for other people even if you're not there with them, but it'd be difficult to paraclete them.
And what about like discipleship passages? Can that also be paracleting for someone
doing
Bible study? Oh. Like things like that, like if you're doing Bible study to someone else, is that
also yes.
Like paraclete, or is that a different
thing? If you're encouraging them to study? Yeah, I think so. There are, living biblically, there are verses that say you should study what God said, or that you should know God and you should understand Him. And a means for that understanding is by listening and studying what He said, seeking wisdom. And so if you were to paraclete someone to seek wisdom, yeah, I think that's definitely paracleting.
I'm interested in your take on number three.
The question number three? Yeah. Yeah, my take on that. Okay.
You asked it first, but.
Right, yeah. Right, I could do your own line on you. My question. So, could Satan and co. paracleo you? Yes, I remember when I read that the demons were paracleoing Jesus, I just almost lost something, I don't know. It was amazing. And then not only that, not only did the demons paracleo, but then Jesus says, okay. So I think that. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So Athens, in the example in the Peloponnesian War, Athens' problems with Corinth is that Corinth is encouraging Potidaea to be antagonistic towards Athens, because one of the things going on is Potidaea pays Athens tribute. So you can see that Corinth is encouraging Potidaea to be hostile towards Athens. And so I definitely think that Satan's one of Satan's tactics to get you off the track is to encourage you to do his agenda and not God's. I also think that he's a little more subtle than paracleting. A lot of these paracletings are very dramatic, over the top, over, you know, I beseech you, right? I think Satan, you know, likes to insert subtle, imperceptive lies, or lies that are not difficult to perceive, to see, more than he would paracleo. That's my speculation. And then, how would you know whether or not it's paracleo from a demon or from Satan? Compare it to the Word. I think that's definitely a first option. If it's saying, you know, go to your boss and tell him that you hate working at your job. I don't see any, you know, biblical stuff says more like, you know, obey your boss. Okay, that's probably not paracleting from God. But I think it takes discernment and reasoning and thinking about it to know whether or not it would be. From which source?
Even Proverbs 1, we are kind of warned against the sinners who are paracleting us. He says, my son, the sinners entice you.
Yeah.
And if they say, come with us. So, clearly, people who are going the wrong way also have company. If I go, there's something with Dutch friends, afterwards they all want to go to bars and drink and drink and drink. They always say, hey, come along. I said, no, it's probably not the best thing for me to do, so far.
If there are no more questions, I'll end us in prayer. God, we thank you for being the God of all comfort, for being our strong tower and the one to whom we can go, and then thereby comfort others and encourage them. I pray that you would establish this body in your word and in your identity, that would be unified in the Spirit, and that you would bless our food. We thank you for sustaining us in multiple ways, including food and nourishment. And I praise you for being who you are. Amen.